So as Livia mentioned, I'm going to be talking about social media and politics. And I think the principles that hopefully we can identify from this can be taken to other areas of marketing as well. So specifically, what we'll be looking at is social media and its interaction with fundraising, with relationships, and in the context of politics, that would be the electorate, and with reputations. And reputations is something, as I'm sure we can imagine, that is of interest and concern to politicians. So to start out with, I like to give this map just to give an idea of where we are in Canada in terms of our internet use. We're one of the highest users in the world, and obviously with that internet use does come with a certain amount of impact in terms of politics as well. But the effect of the internet in terms of politics is still emerging. So we're still not at that point where the internet and social media is what's going to determine an election, although it definitely is moving in that direction. I also like to get a little bit of background in terms of all of you, so I have an idea where all of you are. So I heard a couple of you are now on Twitter, but who's other than those two people, who else is on Twitter in the room? Okay. So maybe about half. And MySpace, Flickr, one, two, Dig. Okay. Delicious. LinkedIn. Okay, quite a few. LinkedIn is a popular one amongst the business crowd. That's definitely true. Anybody use Wikipedia or edit Wikipedia? Okay, great. Facebook. That's usually a big one, especially in Toronto. One of the highest usage of Facebook in the world is right here in this city. YouTube. And Twitter, we mentioned, and blogs. Anyone have a personal blog? Read blogs? RSS feeds? Couple? Okay. Okay. So one of the big, the big thing that everyone's been talking about is obviously the Obama win. This was a campaign which heavily utilized social media. And one of the key things that differentiated him from previous elections was that he opted out of public funding. And he was the first candidate to do that since different laws were passed in the 1970s. He was called the $5 philanthropist. So basically he raised over $650 million. But a lot of this was through small contributions over a wide number of people. So it was really, the small number of people digging up their change and contributing. He was able to get much more than he would have if he went with the restricted amounts under the election laws. Social media is essential to fundraising, and we'll talk a little bit more about how he did that. But it also allowed him, and this is what goes back to what we were talking about before, how the internet is part of a larger campaign. It allowed him to out-advertise McCain, and this is primarily on television. By doing this fundraising, by getting all this money, he was able to do a lot more ads and get the message out that way through television, which still is the primary media which is used in politics today. There are some differences in Canada which would limit a duplication of Obama-type success. We do have a largely public finance system, and the Canadian federal political parties are funded in three different ways. There's tax deductions to parties, and you can get up to 75% of the amount that you donate. There's direct refunds as well. And there's also per-vote subsidy, which is in place. So that's why someone like the Green Party, who doesn't have any seats at all, will actually get more money in the upcoming election or in the interim than the Bloc Québécois, because they actually got more votes in the Bloc, and the Bloc, as we all know, does have seats. There's also a cap and gap in place, so there's an upper limit on spending which is in place, which does, again, limit the amount of fundraising that can occur for political parties. To give you an example of this, next week, as I was mentioning to Livia, I'm actually heading out to Vancouver. I'll be involved in the Liberal Convention. I do have political affiliations. That's how I'm aware of a lot of this stuff, but I will try to maintain it as nonpartisan as possible. But this is one of the tools that the Liberal Party has created, and what it allows you to do, you make your own page, you get to put a smiling picture, and my donors so far have chosen to be anonymous, but what you have is members of the public can actually donate to your registration fee for the conference. I'm pretty much maxed out in terms of my personal contributions, and we mentioned those maxes that are in place in Canada. What this allows is for other people, family, friends, supporters, generally, who haven't reached those maxes to also donate. So it's a way for the Liberal Party to, in a way, get some financing or funding indirectly through the delegates such as myself without contravening the laws that are in place in terms of those maximum caps that are in place. Oh, just give me a second here. Doesn't look like this slide came out. Okay. I'm going to make this available, make sure that the print actually comes out better. So what it basically shows is that by far, I would say the Tories are by far the most advanced and most savvy when it comes to the use of social media. And I don't have this memorized, this chart, but what it did... Oh, is it? It's visible here. Okay, that's good. Okay, so you can see that they use pretty much everything. And this is, again, for the political party specifically, not for the candidates generally. The candidates, the MPs or MPPs, will have their own personal websites, and the party can supply them with templates, so they'll have, you know, the standardized type of web pages that they can use, but they don't have to use those type of templates. And there have been issues in terms of the Garth Turner suspension, which I'm not going to get into, but I will post a link on this when I do actually post the slides. But I think the most important thing to demonstrate here is that the party that federally, at least, that is in power, is very actively using social media, and they're using it for specifically the purposes that we've identified, which is fundraising. You know, right behind them is the Liberals. The Green Party is lagging well behind, as we're going to see in the next slide. These are some of the citizen blogger alliances. So in addition to the formal parties, you actually have citizens as well that go out there and they have their own private blogs that they do, and they sort of had these miniature coalitions. So the big players on the scene in terms of that are the blogging Tories. There's about 300 blogs and an average of 3,000 readers a day. They are by far the largest political blogger alliance in Canada. They have had considerable influence as well in terms of Canadian politics, in terms of the Garmer Inquiry. They leaked information to an American blogger related to the Garmer Inquiry, and as a result, they actually lift the publication ban because information was then publicly available. Liblogs is the liberal coalition that's there. It has been highly influential in the past, liberal leadership, and it still is. It's going to be one of the big things in the convention next week as well in terms of people actually blogging about what's going on. There's the New Democrats Online. They used to be the Blogging Dippers, and they transferred over, I would say, about a year and a half ago. So they've sort of rebranded themselves, made a new logo, new website, and reformulated themselves. The Progressive Bloggers is a coalition of NDP, Liberals, and what they call Red Tories. And they're actually quite large as well. I would say they're probably second to the Blogging Tories simply because their broader political spectrum as well. And as we mentioned, the Green Party seems to be struggling in this respect. They did have the Green Bloggers, but it has been dead for some time and it still has not been reactivated. So they are having some challenges there, and I would suggest that this is one of the areas which they could improve in, because one of the big advantages of social media is that it is cheap. And financing and funding can be a strategic challenge for some of the smaller parties. Question in the back?
So where would you put blogs like Warren Kinsella's blog, or that there's a right-wing woman on the West Coast who's often on Fox News and stuff? Where do they fit in this mix?
Warren Kinsella, I believe, well, I don't know if he's listed in Liblogs anymore, but he definitely would be part of that larger coalition in that sense. He probably is part of Progressive Bloggers, and I would have to double check. They do have all the blogs that they're listed, and it's constantly growing. I would say I get an email maybe every 2 weeks of new blogs that are being added to these. So it's always growing, it's always expanding. I'm not sure which specific individual you're mentioning, but there are, I can think of two ladies in the...
She's a brunette, and she's young, and she's wacky.
I can think of... Two brunettes that I would, I guess I'm not going
to
use the same adjective, but I'm definitely on their radar, and we'll actually get to some of that as well. You know, being politically involved, the blogging scene, people know each other as well, and I try to maintain a far more diplomatic, professional role. But because I am partisan, I do tend to be on the receiving end of a lot of stuff as well. But there are, I can probably mention to you off the top of my head, the largest political blogs in Canada would be Warren Kinsella's site, Small Dead Animals, and 5 Feet of Fury. And so the Small Dead Animals and 5 Feet of Fury are both operated by women who are brunettes, and they are aligned not necessarily formally, but with the Conservative Party and with the right end of the political spectrum. And by far they get, I mean, the Conservative ones by far get far more traffic, but I think a lot of that is also because they have American readership. I run another law website, and we get about 4,500 readers a day, which is enormous. But again, most of the readership does come from the U.S. And I think especially when you're doing political issues or things like that, it does speak to a broader audience, and that's where a lot of their traffic comes from, and it does boost up their rankings in Google and search engines as well as a result.
But we don't have, none of these are like the Huffington Post.
No.
We don't have sexy political blogs like the Americans do. Is that fair to say? And so it's a bigger challenge from a fundraising perspective, would it not be?
I have a couple slides in here I'm going to throw at you guys, which weren't in the ones that were sent out to you. I think there is, you're right, we don't have Huffington Posts, but there are some interesting and amusing things that do go on in the political scene that a lot of people, I would say the average citizen in Canada doesn't necessarily see, which is one of the limitations of social media. Quite often, a lot of the stuff that's going on here is quite internal, so it's party members, you know, diehard type of people that are, you know, kind of talking to each other. The larger public are not necessarily getting this information. They're not necessarily even tuning into this. But that doesn't mean we can ignore it, because these people are highly, highly influential, and they can drive policy. And if they, you know, if they do turn on a politician within the party, or they do have an issue that's very important to them, things can rapidly change even within the party. And we have seen some instances of that. So going back to Obama, some of the social media strategies that he used, he tapped into supporting existing support communities. So one of the examples was there was a Facebook group in support of him, and what they did, what the campaign did, was contact the group owners and said, you know, do you mind if we take this over? And they gladly gave up the reins. And so they used something that there was already some momentum there. You know, those supporters and fans had already sort of done something, and they sort of just took it a step further. One of the issues that came up with that, with the Facebook group, is that there were a lot of detractors as well. So people would post, you know, negative type of stuff. And rather than trying to control that or delete it, they let it go. Hands off, which is probably the best approach that you can have, because what it did was mobilize supporters even more. And they went all out and started, you know, for every one anti-Obama message, there'd be 10 pro-Obama messages to respond to it. So it really did mobilize and invigorate the Obama supporters. But they also maintained a relationship, as we mentioned, in terms of providing exclusive scoops to Obama supporters. So they text messaged, you know, on their telephones, people who were pre-approved and who had been involved in the campaign and who had been supportive, about the choice of Joe Biden before the press conference was even held. So these guys were having exclusive information. I don't think it was, you know, it wasn't a day or two before, but it was earlier on in the day than the actual press conference. So these guys were getting these information scoops and makes them feel special and makes them feel that they're part of something bigger. And I think it's a way to engage your supporters. So, and creating value for them through this use. It's not just I'm a recipient of this advertising, I'm also getting something out of it as well, and I am valued. One of the other key items, and we'll get back to some of this a little bit towards the end, is that they dominate social media outlets. So the largest user on Twitter still is Barack Obama. And we're going to get to that slide in a second, but just so you can see, this is where Twitter users are around the world. Again, primarily North America and Europe, but it is spreading and it is very prevalent even on the Canadian scene. In my opinion, Twitter is going to be one of the big things in the next election, in the next federal election, simply because, from my own personal anecdotal experience, when people who are on Facebook, you notice the shift recently. It went from a different format to a different format with a different layout with your mini feed. I honestly saw probably up to maybe 200 people from my Facebook friends go to Twitter in that same week, because people are now realizing, okay, you know what? Yes, the Facebook is good for certain things like photos and for commenting on different news stories and things like that, but the status updates is really very similar to what happens on Twitter, and I think that's what we're going to see more of a direction towards as well, or at least being incorporated into what social media platforms like Facebook are doing. And to demonstrate, you know, how big Twitter is going to be, this was the best April Fool's joke, in my opinion, of the year. It was a gag by The Guardian saying that they were going to switch to Twitter permanently without any paper at all. So even the print media is actually talking about this as well, and they're realizing the increased surge of the use of Twitter. As mentioned, Barack Obama is the largest user of Twitter. And some of the other people there, he's ranking ahead of CNN, which is quite telling. But one of the limitations here was November 5th, soon after the election, they posted a tweet, and that's the verb for Twitter, when you post something on Twitter, it's a tweet, saying that, thanking all of their supporters, which is great, but what happened after that was the account just sat there. And it did absolutely nothing for weeks and weeks and weeks. And all the supporters were saying, what's going on? You know, why did you sort of engage us prior to the election and engage in this conversation, and then all of a sudden you're just dropping us? So one of my tweets was mentioning that, you know, the U.S. Embassy in Ottawa, the Canadian Embassy, realized this and picked up on it and was actually continued to do these tweets on behalf of Barack Obama, saying, look, he has this new change.gov website. Look, here's a presidential address. So they were still feeding that content. And eventually what happened was he actually did start Twittering again or tweeting again. So here's the post that I mentioned right over here. And these used to be, you know, several tweets a day. This was regular updates you'd get from Barack Obama or from his campaign team, which is why people would actually follow the guy. So we have one on January 15th, another one January 19th, March 25th, and I checked a few days ago and there isn't anything new. So it still has slowed down. But, you know, the point that I'm trying to point out here is that when he didn't continue to use his Twitter account the way he did previously to the election, there was a backlash. People sort of felt a little bit ripped off. And the point there is that social media is part of an ongoing relationship, and you do ignore your supporters at your own expense. There were a number of things that he could have done. I mentioned the change.gov website, which was a website that he had after the election before he was actually sworn in. And also the weekly addresses that he had on YouTube. I mean, it would be relatively simple to say, you know, there's a new address here, here's the link, done. And, you know, that was the type of stuff that was going on during the election. One of the ways that you do accomplish that is, and this is essential for, I guess, microblogging, which is what Twitter is. It's a shorter form of blogging, and status updates for Facebook is pretty much the same thing. You use shortened URLs. So it takes your big, long website address and shrinks it down, because you only have limited number of spaces in your tweet. So it's something that is very useful, and it's actually essential to doing what we're talking about here. One of the first ones was tinyurl.com. Some of the best ones, though, are the ones that I have listed here, and you can check those out. And they rank what's best based on a number of different factors, but one of the most important factors, in my opinion, are the tracking functions. You can actually use one of these services and you'll get the data of who clicked on this link, where they are, sometimes even their IP address, and all kinds of other data depending on the actual service, which goes back to measurement. But also the other big thing is what this does is increases the search engine optimization. So when you have a retweet, for example, that's when you post something on Twitter and someone really likes it, they'll do a retweet and they'll give you attribution, and they'll copy what you said and post it. And sometimes that can go on and on and on. So several people can do that. Google is now ranking or indexing Twitter. And so when you get phenomenons like that happening, it's sort of like Digg. When something is really, really popular and starts getting a lot of readership and has a lot of links going to it from different places, Google bumps it up in the search engine rankings as well, which again is obviously useful because that means more people are ideally going to read it. Another big thing in terms of the last American election is YouTube. NBC had issues with a lot of the videos they were putting there because they said YouTube was built on our ripped-off content. That was, I believe, in 2005 or 2006. But YouTube views have actually exceeded the television viewership of NBC shows in the past. So the broadcasters, what they did was they fought back by enforcing copyright. And so anyone here see the Sarah Palin sketches? I'm assuming everybody, right? Did you see it on YouTube? Anyone, hands up? Who saw it on TV? So about three or four, and the majority of you did see it on YouTube. And again, that's reflected by the stats here, that a lot of people are still seeing these types of things on YouTube as opposed to the primary media, which is television. So although television is still important and it is the primary tool in terms of marketing and politics, we're starting to see some of those changes. So how do you deal with these copyright issues? The McCain campaign complained about yanking his videos too quickly off YouTube and said, you know, they're refusing to give special privileges. But what's, I guess, a little bit ironic about this is that in 2005, he helped vote in the Digital Millennia Copyright Act, which was actually the act that was used in the U.S. to take off copyrighted issues off YouTube. Some of the differences between the U.S. and Canada is that in the U.S., they have a notice and takedown, so they basically give you notice, and at the same time, they'll take down your content, whereas Canada will say, here's a notice and here's another notice, and they give you the opportunity to actually remove the information yourself or to contest it. So the copyright laws are a little bit different in Canada. In Canada, we also did have some amendments to the Copyright Act, and what's interesting again here, similar type of thing in Canada, is that when Jim Prentice, who actually supported this Copyright Act, he allegedly violated his own song copyright in a YouTube video and was upset about the fact that YouTube took down his video as a result as well. So we're having some inconsistent messaging from both the politicians and when they're in office and they're dealing with legal issues as it relates to copyright, and when they're actually on the campaign train as well. And it seems like the two hands aren't really talking to each other, but eventually we'll get there. This is some of the emerging issues in law, but it is something that as marketers we should be aware of as well, that there are some touchy issues as it relates to those types of things. And it does go to the highest level. Barack Obama himself gave the Queen of England an iPod, and apparently on this iPod were MP3s of certain songs that he did not have the copyright to actually provide to her. So this is, you know, the Queen of England and Barack Obama engaged, allegedly or potentially engaging in copyright violations as well. So just to give you an idea that this does go all the way to the top. But going back to Sarah Palin, that probably the important thing to keep in mind is that entertainment does provide value. Users are more likely to participate if it's sort of something that's entertaining, like a Super Bowl commercial, but it is important to remain tasteful, and there is an ability to backfire, and those are important things to remember. In the current provincial conservative leadership, there are these type of gag sites that do exist. So anybody read Paris Hilton or is aware of it? Few people, okay, about half of you, okay. So this is sort of a spoof off that, Paris Hudak, and he's probably one of the forerunners in terms of the provincial Tory leadership race, and they sort of do these little spoofs off the different contenders there. Going back to what I said in terms of the ability to backfire, though, the Conservative Party actually deleted their YouTube ads after the election. And there was some speculation as to why did they do that. A lot of the ads, as you may have recalled, were very much attack ads. We know from a few studies that positive messaging seems to work better than negative messaging, and a lot of this messaging was negative. What it didn't necessarily motivate or engage conservative voters, what it did do was got a lot of liberal voters to stay home. They didn't, you know, they're sort of discouraged and disgusted. The Dion is not a leader type of messaging sort of frustrated people, and they sort of stayed home. So it did work to a certain extent, but the Conservative Party didn't want that up there after the election. Unfortunately, the Infoscape Research Lab, which is based in Ryerson University, they actually preserved all these videos, and you can still get it on their website.
If we were to post some videos on YouTube and have the link from our product pages on our website, if somebody launches YouTube from that web page, mm-hmm. Are they able to go back at any time to the website, or do they have to go launch our website again? Sometimes you get locked in and you can't go back.
Okay, they should be able to, if it's to YouTube, I think they should be able to access the page directly. Almost always they access
when
it directly.
You put link and open it in a new browser.
Oh, I see.
So it'd be a separate page for YouTube, so they close YouTube, your website still.
Okay.
So you're talking about the HTML. Yes, you can put that in your HTML tags for any link. I think it's the open tag. There's a way you can actually make any link that you do open up in a new window. So, and I can't remember what the actual HTML code for that is, but there is a way you can do that for almost any link, including for YouTube.
Okay. Thank you.
One of the things that, and again, going back to the positive messaging, one of the things that some liberal supporters did was talk about the coalition and Harper's response to that, and made a little spoof off I can't remember which film this is. Someone help me out. The Hitler movie that came out recently.
One that starts with a V.
I think that's it. Yes.
I can't pronounce.
Okay.
Valkyrie.
Yes. So they did a spoof off that, you know, sort of dubbing everything and doing a whole. It's entertaining. It's amusing, but it's a very touchy subject as well. And you know, that's why I talked about Dodd's corollary, which is, well, Goodwin's law is that whenever you have an internet discussion long enough, eventually someone's going to become the Nazi. That's sort of the way internet discussions go. And Dodd's corollary is whoever does that, whoever goes to the Nazi analogy, loses the argument automatically. And there is some reasons for that. I mean, in terms of a marketing perspective, it's a very touchy subject. It can be amusing. It is an amusing video. But when you're thinking about how it can be perceived by the larger public, there is a potential for it to backlash, and it's not going to have necessarily positive messaging. We mentioned the coalition. And again, this is going to go back to what I was talking about before in terms of the Conservative Party in Canada has probably been the most effective in Canada in terms of utilizing social media to date. When you look at Facebook events related to the coalition, you can see that they're all well under 1,000 for pretty much every group except for the Support Canadian Democracy National Protest, which was the pro-Harper, pro-Conservative rally that had huge numbers. And that was just this past December. And that was one of the key factors for them being able to get such large people out as well. In terms of shifting to Facebook, because we just mentioned that, if you look at the progress of Facebook from 2004 all the way to 2009, you can see the very, very, very rapid spread. And again, very, very heavily utilized in Canada. It is something that, although I am saying that Twitter is going to be of increasing importance, Facebook is definitely there, especially in Canada. Again, one of the most highly utilized places of Facebook anywhere in the world still is Canada. Some examples of that is, or some good examples of that, is Mayor David Miller, our local mayor here in Toronto. He does quite an effective job of giving regular updates about what he's doing, even photos sometimes. That's TwitPic over there. That's one of the Twitter applications that you can use, of photos that he's doing, of events that he's doing or places that he's going. And he quite regularly updates people about that. So if you're on Facebook, give him an ad and see what he has to say. But you will note that over in the side here it says all official correspondences should go to his email, not to his Facebook inbox, right? So again, this is not an official page in terms of your way to contact the mayor. Another one is Adam Giabroni, who is the TTC chair. One of the examples of something that I saw him doing very effectively in the past few months was, does anyone remember the, I think it was like a hydro explosion or something like that. There was a blackout in the West End and there was some flooding. Does anyone remember that? Okay, there was actually some subway interruptions, and for some reason I was up at like 3 a.m. And so was he. And he was there, you know, saying, I've been up all night. And he's giving, you know, updates every 15 minutes, every half an hour, saying, well, this is what it's looking like. Looks like we're going to have to close the subways for this. Looks like this line's going to be closed. The stop's going to be closed here. So he was giving regular updates for people who would be getting up in that early morning commute. So if they went to his page, they would have seen what the current status of the TTC subway in that region was, which, again, is a highly effective thing. And, in fact, what's interesting about this, even the media was going to his Facebook page to get that information. So going back in terms of social media release, they're getting information from here, not from a PR conference or from a press release, simply because it's a lot easier for him to type in what that update is in 140 characters, and boom, it's there. And you can keep continually updated as well in terms of real time. Another thing, okay, I made this fan page for a client just to show them what it was about. People started joining it, so I said, what the heck, I'm going to keep it there. But the reason why I'm... I don't know. I don't understand it myself. I don't even know some of the people there. Like, some of them are friends and stuff, but there's people there. I don't even know who these people are, which is fine. But the reason why I'm showing fan pages is because this is something that politicians should be doing as well for one important reason. It gives you stats. Okay, it'll give you information who's viewing it, what their demographics are, how frequently they're viewing it. And if you have large enough people in your fan page, this data can actually be very, very, very important. So, again, social media is not just about getting your message out there. You're also getting information about who your supporters are and what the constituency is all about. We're going to move to a different topic now, which is about reputation management. I think, as you can imagine, politics is very similar to other areas of marketing where you're selling a brand, and in the instance of politics, you're selling a political brand and a personality brand. People specifically do want in politics a brand that they can trust. But something that you should keep in mind is that you can't control your brand completely, and you can't stop negative comments. And I think we mentioned earlier how you should be dealing with negative comments. Let it be. And in an ideal world, your supporters will actually come to your defense and will actually mobilize them and can actually have a negative effect towards the people that are trying to criticize you. You can try, in terms of what your efforts, what you're trying to do, you can try to balance out the negative information. So you can try to, and I think this is what we're going to get to, is try to be more proactive about getting your message out there and creating a online media presence. And social media is very central towards doing that. And another thing you can try to do is try to own your own brand. So when someone Googles your name, for example, you should have at least some stuff there that you want people to see. You're not going to be able to control everything. How this relates to politics, and this is from 2005, Minister Jason Kenney, who's made a lot of headlines both in social media and traditional media in the past few months, had made a statement in the House related to reputation management when Don Boudria had actually had his domain name registered by a group that actually opposed some of his policies. He's not an MP anymore, but he was a former MP. And so what he actually said was that this member was ignorant about the commercial practices of the internet, which is a very, very strong statement. And I would be even reluctant to say those kind of statements myself. You know, none of us is an expert, and more importantly, none of us can control what happens on the internet. You cannot control it. So Rick Mercer, what he decided to do, everyone's familiar with Rick Mercer, the Canadian comedian? Okay. So he decided, you know what, this is sort of an outlandish statement to make, so he went and registered jasonkenney.org. And it was available. And so what he did as a result, he redirected it to the Communist Party of Canada. And it was sort of amusing, and he still does own it to this day. So it does kind of demonstrate why you should be a little bit reluctant about making those type of statements. And to demonstrate this, you know, after doing a little bit of preparation for this seminar as well, I also decided to do my own little experiment. So Minister Kenney was coming out to the University of Western Ontario, and he did tweet about it. He's on Twitter as well. There was a lot of protesters there, and I wasn't part of the protesters, but there was a lot of attention towards his talk there. So what I did was I did do an article on him, and I took the snapshot a little bit too late, because soon after I wrote the article, you could type in Jason Kenney just by itself without any other keywords or adjectives, and I was right there above the fold on his first page. Because I got several thousand people reading this article. It became really popular, and it was going all over the internet. And lots of, again, retweets and Twitter directs towards this article. And as a result, right there on the first page, above the fold. And the fold is when you Google something, whatever's on the first half of the screen, that's usually what they describe as above the fold. And in terms of reputation management, what you want to try to do is own this. Okay, and there's a number of ways to do that. We're going to try to get to that. And as I demonstrated here, you know, it is possible to get there, even for someone who is as big as the Minister of Immigration and Citizenship. So you can never control it. So what can you do? Well, there are commercial services that are available. One of them is called Reputation Defender. And what they do is actually go through the internet and try to find people that are, you know, or you'll approach them and say, look, this is someone who's bad-mouthing me or saying something about me. And they'll try to approach that website owner and saying, look, you shouldn't do that. It's potentially defamatory. You could be creating a lawsuit, blah, 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 blah. And that's about all they can do. But how effective really are they? And this just demonstrates it right there, that Reputation Defender can't even defend their own name. That's a blog post. So someone decided to say, look, if these guys are experts in this, let's see if I can really get up there above the fold again. And they did. And what often will happen when people do this, or do use the service, what they do is they actually will blog, because that's what bloggers do, they'll blog about Reputation Defender contacting them about this and this and that. So there is an enormous potential here for a backlash, which is why, in my opinion, those types of commercial services are probably not the best way to deal with those types of things. When you deal with people who are trying to detract from your brand, deal with them professionally, number one. Number two, don't give them too much attention. There's other more positive, proactive ways in which you can deal with things. But there are legal options. This is an example of an American case where $11.3 million were awarded for damages in a defamation case. And defamation can be something that is an option. It is an option both in the U.S. and in Canada, but it's still an area of law which is emerging. It can be incredibly costly. And as you can imagine, again, one of the other downsides is what people can do and what they will do is post all the legal proceedings, every lawyer they ever get from a lawyer, they'll post everything online. So it actually, again, it can backfire. It's like, okay, you want to pick on me? Well, this is my way of fighting back. This is an article from one of the law firms right across the street, And they talk about some of these issues. One of the things they mention, and I do have the link there for you guys, one of the things they do mention is that where a blogger, for example, will post a lot of these legal proceedings online, the courts are more willing to award the maximum amount of damages. So again, this is a way of the courts as well trying to fight back against these people that are not being very cooperative or reasonable in terms of these types of things. But there are, there are better ways than legal proceedings, and we'll get to that in a sec. But before we do, going back to domain name registration, this was a story from just a few months ago, the end of last year. Does anybody know who Meg Whitman is? Yep, one or two people. She's the former CEO of eBay, and she's planning on making a bid for governor of California in 2010. Now, what happened was someone actually registered her domain, her name, with, I think, 2010 or Meg Whitman for governor or something along those lines, and had registered that, and she wanted to actually get that back. She said, look, this is something in my name. The court in the U.S., or it was actually an arbitration, the arbitration actually held that because she did not have any kind of commercial interest directly related to her name, she could not have a trademark interest in common law. So although she was known as Meg Whitman as the eBay person, she had her name associated with eBay, she was not actually holding out Meg Whitman as a brand in itself. So that was that recent decision, but there are decisions that go the other way as well. And this is another arbitration as well, and I have the link to the decision there, of Anna McLellan. She's a former Minister of Justice in Canada, and she had a similar issue where SmartCanuck.com had actually registered her name and had actually posted even some biographical information about her, and then had links to their other main site from that. And they had done this for, I think they did this for about over 300 different sites, or 300 different names and 300 different related types of things, not just for her. And in this arbitration, they actually did say, no, the domain name does belong to her, because they found in that instance there was bad faith, because of the fact that, you know, there wasn't any kind of disclaimer saying that this is not really her official site. It actually had her biography there. So, you know, she actually was able to recover her name in that instance. But again, there's many, many varying shades of gray. Nobody really knows where the direction of this is going. But this is something that, again, something of interest for you guys to keep an eye on, for you to basically be aware of, that you should own your domain name as a URL. So better than these legal options, in my opinion, the legal options are still not very well defined. They're still emerging. They might be a better option in the future, but right now, as they stand, they're not the best option for people in marketing or in reputation management. Something better than that is to become a broadcaster. So you take your brand and you disseminate it against out there amongst the public. And what you do by doing that is you're actually maintaining your brand and being proactive about getting your message out there. But broadcasting is just the beginning. This is a graph showing the social media adoption curve. And so broadcasting is right here, still in the beginning. So you're, you know, it's a push, more of a push medium. You're sending out all your information. What you want to do is go up: participation, relationships, and collaboration. And we talked a little bit about this over here, the relationships and the participation, by having people, for example, engaging in the type of stuff that you're doing, commenting and forwarding the information to others, being empowered by the information that you're providing them. But you can go beyond that as well and actually get collaboration. So this is, you know, social media tools are also a good way to consult with your stakeholder groups and, like I said, get information from them about what their interests are and how they view things as well. So there is more that can be done beyond the broadcasting stage. And by doing that as well, you actually, again, will increase your search engine rankings for all the material that you actually have higher up on the scale. So collaborative type of products will actually protect your brand much, much, much better than something that is simply just a broadcast. This is a schematic of just one of the ways to do this. And it does look a little bit complicated, but it's also similar to the type of thing that I do. I don't use all of these anymore. I don't use Flickr anymore. But anybody here use Ping FM? No? Okay. Ping FM is a service that I use. It's effective because what it does, it allows me to do one status update, and there's probably, what, maybe 12 or 15, even maybe even up to 20 different sites that content then gets distributed everywhere. It goes to my Twitter, it goes to my Facebook status, or one of my Facebook statuses, I have a few, goes to my LinkedIn, goes to a number of different places. goes to a blog as well. And what you, but you can also do the other, the opposite as well. You can have your blog posts go to Ping FM, and that'll go to Twitter. So, you know, Twitter will say, I have a new blog post. And it does it automatically, so you don't have to manually do this type of stuff. So these types of tools are enormously useful because it allows you to quickly get your information out there. But you can't just stop there. And like I said, it's not just a broadcast medium. You then have to go to Twitter, and if people are sending you responses or saying stuff to you, you have to respond to them. You have to go to your Facebook, and people are commenting on your status lines, respond back to them as well, because it is something that is interactive. And it doesn't mean the politicians are directly doing them, but they should have some communication staff working on that. So sort of to sum up, these are some of the principles that I think we've tried to highlight today. This is an article that Livia sent me that she thought would be useful for all of us in terms of the new age of marketing. So this is looking towards the future. How is social media going to change marketing, especially as it relates to politics? And this is an article, the link here, and just to demonstrate. This is what I was talking about in terms of the tiny URLs. You can type something like this in, or you can just do this. So you get the idea, right? And it, especially if you're doing something like Twitter or a status update, this saves you a lot more room. And in fact, this you probably wouldn't even be able to fit in your status update or your tweet. Okay, so that's why these types of tools, again, are very effective.
I'm fairly new to Twitter. And I'm just wondering how you get the tiny URL site, because I've posted a link and it's just shown up as www.website.com. How do you turn it into a tiny URL?
Well, I think Twitter automatically converts tiny URLs. So if you post in a long thing like this, they might actually, not, they do, right? No? I'm seeing yeses and no's.
Not consistently.
Not consistently.
Sometimes it will, sometimes it
won't. Okay.
Oh. Or is it .org?
I think it's .com. That's the best.
I think it's tinyurl.com. That was the first. The best, and you can look at the slides that are there.
Yeah.
This is one of the better ones. And the reason why tinyurl, it was the first one, so I mean it has the name there. But there are other ones that are out there that are better, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many others who are using it, because of the tracking functions. And tinyurl does not have tracking. So these things will actually give you stats. I didn't do that for you guys because I wanted you to click away, but I would normally be able to track this and say, okay, well, how many people after today are going to actually click on this and read these stories? And I didn't do that, so you guys feel free to actually go through with that. But that's why it would be more, another reason why it's better than tiny URL. So you would actually go to, for example, in this instance, bit.ly, and they'll say, enter your